Hi, welcome to Masonic Central. This is November 16th, 2008, and I am Greg Stewart, and this is my co-host Dean Kennedy. This is the podcast for Freemasons by Freemasons. This is a weekly podcast show hosted to explore the depths of the Masonic world. If you're new to the program, feel free to visit our website at MasonicCentral.com or send us an email, which we get so many of, at MasonicCentral@gmail.com. If you send us an email, when we read it on the air, we'll send you some nice goodies to take care of you. This is a live program, so if you're a listener listening down the road, you can listen on the nights that we record and interact with our contributors. And you can follow the conversation live in our in-call chat line that we have going also. All this content is representative of us, the producers and contributors of the show, and does not represent the opinion of any regular or irregular Masonic body or Grand Masonic Lodge. Further, Masonic Central is not... does not have an agenda or a recruitment tool for any particular body or branch of Freemasonry. So welcome to the show. Dean, how are you doing tonight?
I'm good. And you, Greg?
I'm great. It's been a very smoky, fiery Southern California here, but surviving so far.
I'm not going to make any jokes with that one.
Seems like half the state's on fire down here. So anything in the mailbag this week? Have we got anything good?
We did, Greg. We got an auto reply.
An auto reply and some spam, huh?
Yep.
That's auto what reply I remember seeing earlier in the week.
I'm quite surprised we haven't gotten more replies about some of the shows we've been doing recently, but we did get an auto reply from somebody, the out of office auto reply, and that was really fantastic. Thank you very much, Brother Morris.
I guess you could say no news is good news, so we must be doing something right. What do you think?
I'll go with that one.
Anyways, we have a really great show this week. We have author Timothy Hogan, who's the author of the book The Alchemical Keys to Masonic Ritual. And how are you doing tonight, Timothy?
I'm doing great. Happy to be here.
Excellent. Thanks for coming on tonight. You're joining us from Colorado tonight, if I'm reading the board correct.
That's correct. I'm in Aurora, Colorado, as we speak.
Very nice. Very nice. Thank you very much for being here. This is a great book. I've had to say, I picked this book up a while ago and read it through and was surprised how much of this the material in it that actually resonated with stuff that I'd actually come across in just my own sort of research. It's a very nice, concise little book that you have here. I like it a lot. Just kind of wanted to say off the top. for the audience and for those that are listening, maybe you could tell us a little bit of who Tim Hogan is.
Sure. I've been involved in Freemasonry for about 12 years now. So not a really long time, but I do have a long family history in Freemasonry. I'm a past master of East Denver Lodge number 160, where I served in 2004 and 2006, and I'm also a member of Enlightenment number 198 Traditional Observance Lodge in Manitou Springs. I'm also involved in the Scottish Rite. I got a 32nd degree KCCH there. Knight Templar in the York Rite. I'm a past master of East Denver AMD body for Allied Masonic degrees, and belong to a number of other Masonic bodies like the SRICF and the Royal Order of Scotland, as well as a number of research bodies. So that's my, I guess that's my Masonic resume. Aside from that, I like to write, and that's how this book came about.
that's quite a lot of activity in 12 years.
That's
pretty impressive. It sounds like you keep pretty busy with it. Are you active in most of them or some of them or?
I am active in all of them. That I try to be. I'm an officer in everything, and I've over the years I've done a lot of lecturing too, putting on, you know, various classes on the symbolism of Freemasonry. I've done a lot of lecturing both here in the United States and in Europe. and a little bit in Mexico on Freemasonry. And so it's something I'm very passionate about while trying to do my passions. So,
that's great. Wait, did a lot of these lecture opportunities come out of the book, or are they? Do you have a history that precedes the book, I guess?
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny that the book actually came out of the lectures. What happened was is I used to give a lecture pretty routinely on the alchemical connections with Freemasonry. And I printed up a paper because I realized there wasn't, like, there's no way I could say everything I wanted to say in a short talk. So I'd print up a paper that would be handed out to the brethren who came to the talk. And then from there, you know, I just decided that there was more and more that needed to be added. And so that's kind of how it turned into a book.
I know a few scraps of paper as notes go, and it starts growing, and the pile starts to grow. I definitely know that feeling. I definitely want to get into the book. One of the things that I picked up on the book was this long line of Masons that you come from.
Yeah, I've been real fortunate in that my actually on both my mother's and my father's side have a fairly long line of Freemasons. On my father's side, we can trace it back to my great-great-grandfather, Theophil Planck, who came over here from Sweden. He was a Freemason in Sweden, and he arrived in the United States, and he actually arrived in Chicago at the same day as the Chicago Fire. So, then on my mother's side, my middle name is Warren, and it's because my mother's maiden name is Warren, and we can trace our family lineage back to General Joseph Warren, who was a really prominent, you know, Freemason and was involved in the, he was a physician and involved in the Battle of Bunker Hill during the Revolutionary War. But I have a long family history there within Freemasonry. My great-great-grandfather, James Baden Warren, was a charter member of Aquipa Lodge in Pennsylvania. And my grandfather, Hugh Warren, was a, he's the one who kind of got me involved in Freemasonry initially, and he was a metallurgist at Denver University. So he's the one who first kind of started introducing me to this concept that there were alchemical connections within Freemasonry.
Interesting. And I was going to say, just from what I took and looking at the book, when you say they were involved in Freemasonry, that seems to be a little bit of a misnomer, given that they were very involved with it. I mean, it's been something that's been in your family and with a role of importance for some time.
Yeah, that's really true. And, you know, I feel fortunate in that regard. You know, I have, as we speak, I have on my great-great-grandfather's Masonic ring and my great-grandfather's Scottish Rite ring. So, so it's been very much a part of our family history.
That's great. That's great. I know a lot of times when I talk to folks in the public about it, the mention is of having past grandparents be in that, having an interest to it. And it's good to see that the, you know, a lineage like that continues on. That's really cool. So tell us a little bit about your book. The book, again, is The Alchemical Keys to Masonic Ritual. It is available on Amazon. We actually have it available up off of our site for anybody who's listening. It's on our site now. But tell us a little bit about it. Why alchemy? How did you come to connect alchemy and Masonic ritual as things that go with one another?
Well, as I mentioned, my grandfather, Hugh Warren, was a metallurgist at DU. And when I was going through the symbolic degrees, the Blue Lodge degrees of Freemasonry, my grandfather posted me during that time. And so as I was doing my memorization for my proficiency, you know, he's the one who first started telling me, you know, you need to pay attention because some of these things allude to this alchemical process. And at the time, I didn't really know anything about alchemy. But he proceeded to show me a few things here and there and would describe, you know, how these things related to alchemy. So that was my first introduction. From there, I began to read everything I could that that talked about this connection. And what I found was there are a lot of books out there by Freemasons who suggest there's a connection between alchemy and Freemasonry, but they don't go into much detail at all on it. You can find people like Edward Waite, who wrote about there was a Masonic alchemy connection, but he didn't explain how it was really connected too much. Albert Pike seems to allude to it a lot in his writings, particularly Pike's Esoterica, and also some in his Morals and Dogma. Other authors like Manly P. Hall certainly stressed that there was a alchemical tradition in which Freemasonry was a part of, but again, no one really got into specifics, and so I felt like, you know, this was something that was really important that needed to be shared. So that's the that's how the book came to be.
The genesis of it, and maybe for those that are listening, and again, I mean, we can all look it up, but from this book's perspective, tell us a little bit about what alchemy means in this perspective. Because we've associated it with Freemasonry, and just as you said, a lot of folks have mentioned it in a roundabout way. Maybe first tell us how you perceived what they spoke of as alchemy.
Well, first of all, alchemy, the science of alchemy, there's many theories behind the origin of it. One is that the actual name itself comes from alchem, and chem was the name of Egypt. And so it was the science, this Egyptian science that was passed down. We do know that there were Egyptian texts on alchemy. We also know that the Greeks studied it, and these Greek texts were translated by various Islamic mystical orders in the Middle East, like the Sufi. There's some speculation that the Knights Templar got a hold of some of these texts while they were in the Middle East, began to translate them. We certainly find evidence of this science of alchemy within the works of, we know that the Templars, for example, were using mold extracts to create cures for diseases, which we would recognize today as being, you know, messing around with antibiotics. And we also know that the early cathedrals, the cathedrals that were built in the 1200s in particular, in France, normally we think of them as being covered with, you know, just depictions of scenes from the Bible, but on many of them, and particularly the Cathedral of Notre Dame in Paris and Chartres Cathedral, they're actually covered all over the place with all the operations of alchemy. So it was a fundamental, in fact, at Notre Dame in Paris, if you look at the very front door of the cathedral itself, there are several medallion plates at eye level, and they show all the stages of alchemy. They show things like salamanders on fire and stars issuing essences and furnaces and all these things that really have nothing to do with the Bible per se. So this was very much a part of that tradition. Now, fundamentally, alchemy was concerned with taking something of a lesser valued nature and subjecting it to processes in which all the impurities were removed so that you could result in a substance that was more precious and more refined and better. And this is very much what we talk about within Freemasonry that we do with our brothers as they go through the initiation process. Our slogan is, you know, we take good men and make them better. Well, that's a transmutation. And so it's very much, from my perspective, is very much tied there.
Now, and one of the things that you definitely talk about in the book, and even within that idea of this sort of transformation, it seems to me that there's a step in between the older ideas of alchemical transformation of, you know, we're all familiar with the lead to gold. But how do you think that it jumped from this physical to this more philosophical? Any reflections or ideas on that?
Absolutely. And actually, you know, it's one of those which came first, the chicken or the egg questions, really, because we know that if we look at the ancient initiation rites within the mystery schools of Egypt or Greece, some of the early Gnostic schools of initiation, the early Christian schools of initiation, they went through several stages or baptisms, if you will, they basically had a degree system like we find in Freemasonry, where they would start out with a baptism by water, and then by air, and then by fire. These are the classical alchemical elements, and they also were the significance of them, where they also define the alchemical process itself. So not only did the elements represent states of matter, but they also represented states of consciousness. You know, earth was represented as things physical, attachment to the physical world. Water represented the emotions, mastery of the emotions. Air represented the intellect. And fire represented a spiritual understanding or connection with the grand architect of the universe. So this idea was utilized not only in the lab, but it was also utilized in the initiation rites within these older schools. And incidentally, we also find these exact same initiations within Freemasonry. Today we would recognize them connected with the penalties associated with each obligation within Freemasonry, where we progress from water to air to fire as a master mason. And so looking at these connections can provide some real insight into what the degrees are trying to tell us, from my perspective.
That's it seems to me that it links up so much, because we're looking at this, I guess, in an alchemical aspect. So we're kind of putting it into a narrow crucible, if you will, to coin some of the phrase. But do you think that it starts to connect out to a broader term? I know in a lot of areas we look at this as being an extension of a religion or tied to it in some aspects. One of the things that I've found, and I'm curious your take on it, is the connections to these older what do you think about that?
I think there is definitely a connection between some of these older traditions and Freemasonry. In my mind, there's no doubt, no doubt at all. And, you know, we know, for example, there's lots of theories behind the origin of Freemasonry. You know, some people say, oh, well, it goes back to the cathedral builders. Some people say, oh, it goes back to the Knights Templar. Well, we know that the cathedral builders and the Knights Templar were working together. And these sciences that both were utilizing are on the cathedrals themselves, which are directly tied to the alchemical process. Some people say that Freemasonry is tied to the Royal Society of Britain, for example. Well, the early Royal Society, what were they principally concerned with? They were studying alchemical texts. In fact, 80% of everything Isaac Newton ever wrote on was on alchemy. And people like Robert Fludd were studying these things. Elias Ashmole is another one who's everyone likes to point out as the first speculative Freemason. What was he doing with himself? He was an alchemist. He was studying alchemy. So I think that, you know, keeping all these things in mind, you know, the alchemists drew their inspiration from several different sources. They were concerned with ancient wisdom. They were concerned with Hermetic texts, particularly the works of Hermes Trismegistus, the Corpus Hermeticum, Emerald Tablet, that type of thing. They were concerned with Kabbalistic writings. And they were concerned with some of the Gnostic lineage. And all these things went into, they believed that all these things contained a symbolic language which related directly to alchemy.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, we find remnants of all these things within the degrees of Freemasonry themselves.
You know, and I'm curious your thoughts on it. How do you see that it was separated? Do you see that it was just sort of an assumed role, or do you think at one point that this was something a little bit more studied than it is today, that there's been a dropping off of that at all?
I do definitely believe that it was studied more in the past. We know it was. You know, if you look at, for example, Mozart's lodge had a practicing alchemy lab in it. How many lodges today have that? If you go overseas in Europe, there's a lot of lodges that actually still alchemy is a fundamental part of their teachings. But here in the United States, it's kind of dropped off, and I think it began to drop off. It had to have been starting around the Civil War, and definitely by World War II. It had dropped off. And we know this because if you look at the writings of Masons, for example, like in Albert Pike's day, alchemy was still very much being talked about as part of the alchemical Masonic tradition. Alchemy and Freemasonry were very much connected. However, by the time you start getting after World War II, it's virtually no one's talking about it anymore.
Non-existent, and you know, it's something interesting, and I'm curious your thought. Even the writing though of Pike at that point, and the letters that followed him, it seemed almost to have a romantic notion of it. So,
uh-huh.
So it was as if it were a reliance on memory. You know what I mean? So it's not even a first-hand knowledge of it anymore, but a second-hand sort of storytelling about it, rather than a practical application.
I absolutely believe that, and I think that that's almost because. I mean, like, you read Pike, for example, in Morals and Dogma. He talks about things like the three substances that, you know, the sulfur, the salt, and the mercury that went into creating, the symbolic philosopher's stone but in alchemy. But he never, he doesn't go much further than that, you know, and he does a whole lot of saying, oh, yes, you know, This was part of the alchemical tradition, but not much further. So,
but without going into detail to it,
right.
I you know, and I wonder. It's interesting that the connection. I think it's been a date that's probably rolled around in my thoughts. But the point that you speak of, I mean, really goes back to the disaster of the Morgan affair, this sort of this decimation of American Masonry to lose all this.
Yeah, well, and we've seen certainly, you know, Freemasonry's, you know, received its share of persecutions. I think that was a huge upset. I think we had a huge influx of membership around between the world wars. But even with that, you had a lot of brothers who joined and went off to war, and they never really got the full teachings, if you will, of the craft. And by the time they came back, you know, there's just things that weren't passed down, you know, in my perspective of this. However,
a lost memory. Go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. However, I mean, that's not to say that it was completely lost. I mean, there are brothers still talking about this, not just in Europe, but you find it here in the United States. I've been surprised after I did publish my book how many brothers have approached me and said, "Oh, I'm so thankful that you published this, because this is, you know, this is the type of things we've been trying to pass down to one degree or another, but it's just not being talked about widespread enough." So most Masons, it's too hard for them to conceptualize what doing work in a lab has anything to do with initiation, which has anything to do with the metaphors for King Solomon's temple. They seem like totally, you know, incongruent things, but whereas they really are connected. So
you know, it's interesting with the aspects of this physical transformation of the fraternity from that time in the late 1800s into the 1940s and then through today, the fraternity actually taking on this role of transformation, you know, that we talk about so much as an aspect of what it does, that it actually came off onto the fraternity itself and has been transformed since and into what we have today. And I'm curious that with that in mind, your ideas to how alchemy applies today in the fraternity. How would someone be able to look at the fraternity and be able to make those connections to 40 years of distilled ritual and history into these older connections? What worked for you? What sort of things went into your process of reconnecting it?
Well, the beauty with Freemasonry is it is passed down relatively unchanged from mouth to ear. And even if the person who's transmitting the ritual doesn't understand these things, the person who's being initiated into it, if they take the time to meditate on what's being put before them and to really think about it, they can begin to see these connections. I mean, we're told, you know, when we first go to be initiated as an apprentice, we're told that many of the things we encountered may have seemed of a light and trifling character, but they're there to inform us that they are not. There's wise and serious truths there. And then we're told as a Master Mason that, we think we're in possession of the secrets of a Master Mason, but we do not possess those. We have a rough and rugged road ahead of us. And so these things are telling us right away that there is great mystery contained within the ritual itself. And just because you've received the ritual and be given the symbols associated with it doesn't mean that you understand it. And it takes an active participation on each Freemason that goes through these to learn how to read symbols, to learn how to interpret symbols, and see how they relate to something bigger. Let me give an example related to alchemy and Freemasonry. You know, one of the things that we're introduced to within the degrees is the idea of we're introduced to the wages of a thalacraft, the corn, the wine, and the oil. And these three substances are used in all cornerstone ceremonies, in which they're sprinkled on this cornerstone, which becomes the foundation of a building. In alchemy, in early alchemical texts, there were three main substances that went into forming a stone, or the philosopher's stone, if you will. There was the salt, the mercury, and the sulfur. And the salt was the incombustible body of a thing, whether it be a metal or an herb. And it was sometimes depicted in alchemical texts as corn, because it can be found everywhere. The mercury was believed to be a life force, if you will, that was contained within the air, and it was attracted to liquids, particularly alcohol. And so the mercury was always depicted as wine. And the sulfur was the oils of the thing being worked on. So what do we have here? We have corn, wine, and oil that go together onto a stone, in this case a cornerstone, which in the early alchemical texts, going back to the as early as the 1400s, the philosopher's stone was depicted as a cornerstone. So here we have this whole symbolic language that's right there for us, if we take the time to try to understand it.
You know, it's interesting, and to what you said about the great mystery that's not really, not fully given in the overall of the fraternity and the process that we go through, it begs the question, do you think that there is an absolute answer to it at some point, or is it a system that's built to be subjective? Is it an open interpretive system?
I think it is open to interpretation. I think it's I would be, I don't think it would be correct for me to say, well, it all relates to alchemy, period. I don't think that's it at all. I think Freemasonry has several influences on it. But I do think that if we understand the alchemical process, which I try to outline in the book, and show how that relates to the degrees, it breathes new light into the meaning behind what we're memorizing and what we're going through. And once we have that new interpretation or that new meaning, we're free to speculate on it in new directions that just weren't available to us before. You know, how often do people say, well, the secrets of Masonry are the passwords and the signs and the dugards. Well, I would argue that those are actually the keys to the secrets of Masonry, because within those things contain these alchemical processes, if you know what you're looking at. So the things in themselves aren't the secret. They contain secrets within them.
Like the secrets hiding in the secret itself.
Yeah, exactly. And there's so many things like that. I mean, to give you an example, you know, one of the words that we're familiar with in Freemasonry, in which you find outside of Freemasonry too, is the word shibboleth. And this word, we are told, has come to mean a sheaf of corn hanging over a water ford. That's what it's come to mean, but that doesn't mean that's what it means. It's come to mean that. However, if we look at that word in Greek, for example, that word actually means something. It means I revere a stone. Well, that's really interesting. You know, if you're looking at that from either as a stonemason or as an alchemist, I revere a stone has meaning to it. It's pointing in a direction. Whereas if you didn't know that, it's just a funny word. To take it one step further, if you take that word in Greek and apply in the second degree lecture, we're informed there's almost a throwaway sentence that talks about how letters can variously be replaced with numbers. And, you know, this was an ancient science that the alchemists used that was called gematria, in which every letter corresponded to a numeric value. And so you could add up, if words that were in Greek or in Hebrew, and get a numeric value out of it that had a symbolic meaning. Well, the word shibboleth, for example, when it's in Greek, if you add up all the letters in that word, it adds up to 1307. And the people go, well, what's 1307? Well, it's an interesting coincidence that 1307 is the year that the Knights Templar were suppressed. So it might be pointing in a direction there. But unless you seek these things out, you'll never, you'll just take it as what it is, as a word, and that's that.
And I think in many ways that's been the notion. You forget you think you know how to play the game, but you lose the instructions to it, and you just continue on playing it the way that you're used to playing it, and you lose sight of ideas like that. There are actually a lot of sort of references like that in the book itself. The different aspects and different words that you've gone through, and done comparisons to.
Sure.
To get these ideas, and even just one that was interesting that struck me is in the word Christ, and taking the T out into Greek, it's translation for the word of gold.
Yeah, that's right. If you take Christos and you remove the cross from it, or the T, the tau, in Greek, it spells the word Chrysos, which is the Greek word for gold. And some alchemists actually saw the Bible as full of alchemical allegory and almost a recipe book for how to do certain procedures if you knew how to read it properly. And quite significantly in my mind, those same particular passages within the Bible that have to do with alchemical operations, that the early alchemists believed had to do with alchemical operations, are all the same passages that are emphasized in the degrees of Freemasonry. So it was almost like these were saying, hey, pay attention to this. There's something important here in the Bible if you know how to read it. And it wasn't just the Bible. I mean, there were a number of texts that ancient texts that alchemists studied. For example, Sir Isaac Newton studied, in particular, the Metamorphosis by Ovid, because he believed that was contained, all kinds of alchemical recipes within it, if you knew how to read the language. He also thought that the descriptions of Solomon's temple in the Bible contained coded messages related to alchemical processes. So even though there's no definitive proof that Isaac Newton was a Freemason, per se, we do know that he was a practicing alchemist, and we do know that he was very intensely interested in everything related to Solomon's temple, in particular in the Old Testament, because he believed that references to Solomon and the temple contained alchemical formulas.
This is interesting, and you taking it to that point, and these practicing alchemists back at that time, and a path that I've gone down, and a lot of the research I've done, and just looking at it, I'm curious your thought. Do you see any past connections to the Rosicrucian ideas, the ideas of Rosicrucianism, and the developments on that end, and how it may have related to Freemasonry?
I do, but there's no way of proving that the Masons came out of the Rosicrucians, or that we do know as early as the 1600s there were actually newspaper articles in the mid-1600s going all the way into the 1700s that talked about things that would say the order of the Rosy Cross is going to dine on this date with the Order of Accepted Masons, which is interesting, nothing conclusive. But one of the things we do know is that if you look at just as the symbolic degrees of Freemasonry, the Blue Lodge degrees of the Entered Apprentice, Fellowcraft, and Master Mason degree, outline the entire alchemical process, we find that exact same process outlined in some of the early Rosicrucian manifestos, like the chemical wedding of Christian Rosencrantz, for example. They may have used slightly different language, slightly different metaphors, but they were outlining the exact same process. So in that regard, it demonstrates to my satisfaction and in my mind that there was a shared body of knowledge that was being passed down, whether we, accept that Freemasonry came out of Rosicrucianism or Rosicrucianism had any connection with Freemasonry. They were both passing on the same secrets.
It's interesting. Just as pet theories go, I've always sort of had the idea in the back of my head that there was a split between the two, that a physical and a philosophical end of it. So you have the practicing Rosicrucians on the mystical side and the more stalwart physical attributes of Freemasonry taking over.
Well,
two different chains of thought.
Well, it's interesting. We're told that we are involved in speculative Masonry. And speculative, of course, means that you're philosophizing or you're speculating on the significance of things. It becomes more of a internal spiritual alchemy, if you will. Whereas there was also an operative art. And long ago, alchemical texts going back into the 1400s make it very clear that alchemy is not to be understood just as a science, that where you can make plastic or whatever. It was actually meant to be a philosophical discipline as well. So, while someone was working in the lab and they were going through these different processes that were external outside of themselves, they should also be focusing on and meditating on things within themselves to bring about their own transformation as well. So there was a connection, both within and without. And within Freemasonry, this idea is still passed on in the form of initiation. But of course, there's not too many Masons nowadays that have labs set up in their houses where they're, messing around with stuff. So there are a lot. You'd be surprised how many Freemasons I have encountered that have
tinkered with it in some aspects. Absolutely, I think I know where you're going to go with this, Dean, and that's actually my next question: is do you see this having a practical application in Masonry today? Do you still see this practicing alchemy taking place in a broad way? Or
I do. I mean, it's certainly available for anybody who wants to go down that path. I mean, alchemy it was a philosophical discipline. It was a practical exercise. It was one in which the whole basis behind it was, if you were to sum it up in a sentence, you could say it was spiritualizing the material and materializing the spiritual. It was an integration between these two opposite, normally what we associate as opposite extremes, And, there are certainly benefits that can come out of doing lab work. I mean, aside from the internal processes, there is the ability to create elixirs and such, which can be good for you. In terms of your health and welfare. And there are brothers who practice this, and there are starting to be brothers. There's starting to be lodges that are looking into this more seriously and beginning to tinker around with the ideas of, well, what would it take for us to set up a lab within our lodge, for example, so that we can start looking at some of these ideas. I know of a couple lodges that are doing that.
That actually might be a good to follow up on. The idea of what you mentioned just a moment ago about the practical exercise of the spirit energizing the material and then vice versa, you know, the whole idea of above and below, below and above. It seems to me almost maybe even a more modern Western idea of trying to channel the energy into something to produce something else. So just as you're trying to turn the material into gold or whatever, the tenecturum process that you're trying to derive from it, going back to the philosophical idea of trying to capture that focus, you know, like tarot cards or meditation or
sure.
anything that you put your energy into to derive something else. So it's not necessarily about let me take these spirits and turn it into a salt and then so on and so forth. But through that process, it leads to something more, which, you know, in just in asking that, maybe reading more into it than what's going on.
No,
but I'm curious.
I think you're right on as far as that goes. I mean, in fact, the alchemical texts are very specific that, I mean, as early, again, in some of the earliest alchemical texts, they make it very clear that there's a connection between the mind of the practitioner and the experiment itself. And that the alchemist, through his own will and intention and connection with his experiment, can bring about certain shifts of matter and changes of states of matter, which maybe your average scientist would not be able to do because of this mind connection. There's a lot of ideas that were very popular in alchemical texts, you know, as early, you know, going back to the, you know, the 14 through 1600s, that were then dismissed entirely in the 1800s and early 1900s. And now with the advent of modern science, with physics, quantum physics, some of the theories behind superstring theory and some of these other things, they're beginning to go back and say the exact same things that these earlier texts said. An example is, you know, the alchemists would talk about the four states of matter, and then they also referred to a fifth state, which they called the ether, the quintessence. It was always represented by a five-pointed star. And this quintessence gave birth to the other elements. And it was said to be this this energy, if you will, that kind of binds everything. Well, then in the 1800s, they decided, oh, well, ether doesn't exist. And now today, they talk about things like a quantum field, which is in which elements come out of, which is the exact thing that they were talking about back in the, you know, the 1500s. They've just given it a new name.
Right,
so,
right. Back full circle to it. I hear you. I agree wholeheartedly. One of my passions is reading Discover Magazine and other sort of scientific journals and just to sort of pick up on these things. And it is amazing to see how much these ideas are coming back. The ideas and aspects of dark matter, and you know, it's that other realm sort of existence of stuff that we just sort of said it didn't.
Right.
And here it is, and we've been talking about it as, you know, those sort of fifth elements. And just in reading some of the questions of some of the folks that are listening, I'm curious, is there sort of any startup guide to any of this? If anybody had any interest in even exploring the ideas for this outside of the book, and certainly your book's a good stepping stone to going into it, any guidance as to anybody who wanted to go out there besides picking up a chemistry set at the local the local Walmart?
Yeah, I mean, there are a number of good books out there on the subject. My book was written specifically to try to tie in masonry and alchemy so that if a brother did have an interest, once they understood the general process and they wanted to take it further, they could. Some of the other books that are out there that are on alchemical processes just in themselves, which are pretty good, include there's a book called The Alchemist's Handbook by Frater Albertus, which is quite good. There's also a book called The Sorcerer's Stone by Dennis William Houck, which is good. There's another book called The Practical Handbook of Plant Alchemy by Junius, which is good. These are all good introduction texts to alchemy and helps, can help walk somebody through that. However, you know, another resource, particularly for Freemasons who might be interested in it, is I do teach a course through the SanctumSanctorum.com website. There's a I teach an Alchemy 101 course. You have to be a Master Mason in order to take it. But that's also a resource for brothers who be interested in going through the learning the alchemical steps and actually getting their hands a little dirty and doing some of these alchemical processes. And the nice thing about the class in that regard is that it actually relates each stage of the process that you're doing to things that you've learned as you went through the degrees themselves. So it can become a very personal experience in that regard.
Anything that they'd be able to derive from that class? Any elixirs or any...
Absolutely. Yeah, actually, by the time you're done with the class, you will have been able to take an herb, and they get into the different types of herbs that you could use, be able to extract out its three main essences, which were its salt, its sulfur, and its mercury. And then you'll be able to recombine those to form an elixir or also a vegetable stone out of that. So it's a pretty exciting course. It also teaches brothers how to extract, you know, one of the secret salts within alchemy was called the mana. And there's, if you look at mana in the Bible, mana in Hebrew actually just means what is it in Hebrew. And it had a numeric value of 90, just like the number of degrees in a master's square. But it, you know, mana plays an important part in particularly the degrees, some of the appendant degrees within the York Rite and the Scottish Rite. And, you know, the class shows how to extract this mana and talks about some of the characteristics of it. And it's quite exciting in that regard. So by the time you're done with it, you know, by the time you're done with it, not only do you have an elixir, not only can you make an elixir and a stone, which have tremendous health benefits, but you've also gone through that whole process, which is pretty exciting. So I should say, I want to point out one symbol that is really fundamental in my mind within alchemy and Freemasonry that we have all the time. And most brothers aren't aware of it, and that is the actual Master Mason's apron. You know, as an alchemist, you would wear an apron too because you didn't want to get the stuff on you. But the significant thing about the Master Mason apron in particular is that the shape of it is the exact same shape as the old alchemical cipher for a crucible or a calcination dish. And that's pretty interesting, especially when we consider, you know, when we look at some of the symbolism in the Master Mason degree associated with fire, you know, is tied to, you know, we can look at the apron, we can look at the password of the Master Mason degree, we can look at the grip of a Master Mason, the strong grip, the shape that your hand is in when you make that grip is actually in the shape of the Hebrew letter Shin, which was equated with fire. And in fact, both Eastern Orthodox and Jewish priests bless with their hands in that position for that reason. So these are, and then of course the penalty within the Master Mason degree relates to fire too. So these again
just,
are just some
Tim,
of the
just
ideas.
A note. Just a note. Just be careful because we don't. All kinds of people can listen to this.
Okay.
Hey, open forum.
Got it. You got it.
And just a, totally off topic now, because we're actually coming to the end of the hour here. These are all definitely things to look into and follow up on. Any chance you have a website or anything like that that you talk to, or do you spend a lot of your time at the Sanctum Sanctorum and publish a lot on there about this?
I do a lot on the Sanctum Sanctorum. I also do some posting on the Masonic Society website for members of the Masonic Society. I don't have a personal website myself, so.
This is definitely interesting material to study, especially how it starts to relate to beyond the transforming things on your counter or on your lab, and as it relates to the more spiritual aspects of it. You know, the equating well this to this and this to that. It definitely worth delving into for anybody who hasn't delved into it. And I understand you're an author of other books, not just about alchemy here. You've
I have done some other publishing. I have another book called Revelation of the Holy Grail that is written under a pen name of Chevalier Emrys, which just means Knight of Light. And it gets more into the history of the mystery school tradition from ancient times into the modern day. It does talk some about alchemy. The earliest reference to alchemy was in ancient Sumer, where it went under the name of Gra'al, Gra.al, which was really the origin of the Holy Grail tradition. So I get into a lot of that and show how that ties in the book. And I've also done some writing for some other magazines, including magazine Ariadne's Web and a magazine called La Iniciación. And I just recently had an article in the first Masonic Society magazine as well. So
all definitely things take a look for. Anything to look out for? Any books coming up? Any?
Well, I may be publishing a book soon on the Kabbalah and its relation to Freemasonry.
I do know we had some interest in that actually recently from a few of our listeners about the Kabbalah and the tie-in with Masonry.
Yeah, in alchemy, I mean, there's a real close marriage between alchemy and Kabbalah, and so, in fact, some have interpreted the metaphor of when Isaac Newton discovered gravity under a tree, an apple tree. Alchemists have always looked to that as relating to the Kabbalistic tree. Which was also called Jacob's Ladder and a number of other things, but it was basically composed of different spheres of association. And these spheres were associated with planets, and they were also associated with metals. And Isaac Newton was studying this connection between the invisible forces between both metals in the lab and the planets in the sky, because there was believed to be a connection both above and below, just like the globes in the Masonic Lodge, and when he discovered gravity. So some have seen that as a metaphor.
That's very interesting. I that's one area that I've just sort of delved into recently in looking at the Scottish Rite and the Kabbalah, and obviously there's certain things that they allude to very early on, but the broader structure of it. And how it relates throughout, you know, again, areas that I don't think that are often explored. I'm definitely going to keep an eye. Any working title in mind for that?
No, not at this time.
Did you need a podcast to deliver like the you know when you unleash it?
I'll be sure to let you know. Yeah, I'll be sure to let you know.
Well, Tim, thanks for this. We're at the top of our hour here, and I hate going over because then we're definitely taking advantage of our service with TalkShoe. But this is great information. I having read the book, I know Dean hasn't read the book, unfortunately, so he's sorely in the dark. But having read the book and being able to talk to you about it and hear about it, I'm very glad that I did. Anybody who has not read the book again is The Alchemical Keys to Masonic Ritual. We have it available presently at MasonicCentral.com if you look for our little Amazon widget. Or if you're out and about looking on Amazon, look for it. The author's name again is Timothy Hogan. The book is The Alchemical Keys to Masonic Ritual. And Tim, thanks for coming on. Thanks for talking to us this week.
Hey, thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.
And if for anybody out there who's looking for more on this, the Sanctum Sanctorum, is it sanctumsanctorum.com?
Yeah, www.thesanctumsanctorum.com. All one word.
If you do a search in Google, I know I've done it a few times to find it. It's a little bit hairy to find, but look for it. You'll know when you're there. One of those great sites. So. Very good. Thanks for coming on. Dean, you want to go over real quick who we have coming up in the next couple of weeks?
We should, shouldn't we?
I think it would be good.
We have some great ones coming up. Do you have the calendar in front of you?
I sure do. Next week we have Chris Hodapp coming on, who's got more sticks in the fire than I think all of us combined. I actually talked to him just the other day about something that we'll be talking about a little bit next week, maybe. But Chris Kodap's coming up next week. We have Pip Fox coming on, who actually, Tim, you might be interested in listening to and maybe chiming in on. We're going to talk about Cagliostro and the Egyptian Rite. So a lot of alchemy. Oh, man, this has been a long hour. A lot of alchemy in that and definitely ties to the mysticism. And other sort of magical aspects. Very interesting. Following that, on the 7th, we have coming up, if I'm not mistaken, Brother Anderson from Texas, from the... Where am I? I'm blanking here.
Someone will give us it soon.
Yeah, we'll definitely fill you in on who's coming up. And then that's going to lead us out almost into the year. We have our Table Lodge coming up that we've been talking about week in and week out. So guys, keep your eyes open for that. And then we may have some changes coming up with where we host this. So if you haven't been following along, definitely check us out. MasonicCentral.com. Send us an email at MasonicCentral@gmail.com and check out our calendar, which is also at MasonicCentral.com, which is our blog that we post as often as we can. So
You should mention next week we want to have a real letter in with me. We don't want to be reading about an autoresponder.
If you've listened this far, send us an email and just let us know what you think. We'd love to hear it. We'll forward any questions you have on to Tim. And if anything else comes up, we'll definitely take it front on. And we do send out bumper stickers. You guys will get your goodies in the mail. So that's all I got. Dean, you got anything else?
You know, Greg, you do a fantastic job, and I'd just like to congratulate you on the great interview you did tonight, and I kind of stayed out of your way, and things seem to work out quite well without me being too much involved.
Get out of here. I definitely do not take that as your resignation, buddy. It's not me, it's the guest. Thanks, Tim, for being on the show. We'll
can't resign.
What? Not that I'm saying goodnight to Tim. Thanks, Tim, for being on the show. Look for his book, The Alchemical Keys to Masonic Ritual, and it's available on our website. Dean, you ready to go?
Yeah, but we should remind everyone to stick for the post show chat.
Stick around for the post show fun. All the gloves come off, and we end up in the parking lot. All right, everybody, check out our website, and we'll talk to you soon. This is Greg Stewart saying. Oh, Greg Stewart and
Dean Kennedy.
Saying
travel
light.